Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, his book is called Bedroom Rapper, Cadence Weapon on Hip-Hop, Resistance, and Surviving the Music Industry. Just dropped recently, and I'm very glad to have Raleigh Pemberton on the show to talk about it. How's it going?
Going well. How are you doing?
Doing all right. So is this a pandemic project? Did you start writing this because, you know, things as a live musician maybe took a little bit of a downturn?
I wonder how long we're going
to
be talking about that, right? You know, it fully was. I mean, it was something that I started at the end of 2019, I would say, where the idea, okay, you know, I'm talking to this publisher about writing a book. I started working on the book proposal. And then early, you know, 2020, you know, the pandemic happened, and then I had a lot of free time on my hands. Mm-hmm. So I would say, yeah, the majority of the book was written over the pandemic, but I'd written some of it before.
Now, the project, if it was, you know, starting the ball rolling with the publisher in late 2019, was it a memoir at that time, or was there, like, did it take shape after you'd kind of,
well, you know, it's actually interesting, because I'd say even earlier than that, I had started what was basically a fictionalized account of my experiences DJing.
Mm.
And I called it Train Wrecker. And, you know, I'd written, you know, one chapter of it. And, you know, I even actually performed it at this festival in Edmonton. Like, I just read the chapter or whatever. But then I got some advice to maybe just be honest and be like, okay, let's do something autobiographical. Let's, you know, have you ever thought about doing a memoir? And so I actually adapted some of that chapter, which became Universal Heartbeat, the DJ chapter in the book. And that's kind of how I went in that direction. So that started like mid 2019.
So taking something that you'd conceived of as like a fictionalized version of a DJ story that was obviously drawn on your real experiences as a DJ, and then back in the train up and like reworking it so that it actually told your story. What was that experience like? Because I mean, obviously as a writer, you know, you write yourself in a lot of your lyrics, but sometimes you talk about, you know, doing research on other people's lives and on other topics and things like that. But like essentially like fictionalizing yourself and then undoing that, what kind of mental gymnastics or process is that like?
Oh, it wasn't too hard. You know, it was like, it was just this thing where I would take out, you know, the main points that I mentioned that were real in the fictional version, and just kind of write around them, you know. And I think it's just a thing where every day I would just, you know, write for as long as I could, you know, just during the pandemic. I would write during the day, you know, like it was like a 9-to-5, right? And I would just do that every day. And then at night I was working on Parallel World, my album. So I was just extremely productive during the pandemic.
Were you listening to music while you write? Are you someone who can put music on in the background, or does it demand too much of your attention?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I listen to music all day. So, you know, I don't find it distracting, you know, even if it has words. But typically what I was listening to was like a lot of ambient music.
Mm.
You know, I don't know. Maybe it makes me feel like I'm in a film or something, like I'm I'm just typing away and it's just some like Brian Eno, and it's like, oh, my life is being scored right now.
Music for airports and bedroom rapper writing.
Yeah.
I have to ask, you drop it right at the beginning talking about your parents. They dropped out of college and they toured around following Parliament Funkadelic. And it's just like one kind of line in the book, and I'm like, God, I want to know more about like the decision to do this. What that experience was like, did they talk about it when you were growing up, or is that something that was like mentioned offhand? Like, I'm fascinated by the fact that your parents did that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just like an aside, you know, it was never really a big deal to them. Like, it was, you know, back then, you know, they just lived for the funk. That's all they cared about. You know, I think I take after them very well. They were huge music fans always, you know, growing up, constantly hearing music in the house. They're constantly playing like Funkadelic and Cameo and, you know, all kinds of like 80s R&B and
Phyllis Hyman. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that's just what I'm absorbing all the time. Just, you know, they didn't play me Mozart, let's say, you know.
Right. And obviously your dad, you know, was a DJ in Edmonton, and you got the experience of like going and sitting in with him on his show. And then eventually like he kind of like handed you the reins one evening. But then in the hallway afterwards, you write about, you know, running into another DJ and he's like, nah, man, he's going to do something different.
And yeah.
Then you talk about, you know, when your father passes away, you perform a poem at the sort of service, and feeling like you kind of were able to step out from under the weight of his expectations or his judgment. Do you think you would have the life and the career and the avocation that you have had your father not passed?
I don't think so. You know, I don't think I would have had been confident enough to do it, or it's weird. It's like, I feel like in the absence of having him around, you know, it allowed me to kind of become my own person or something. Or, you know, I was always like very reserved as a kid, and I didn't really express myself openly for a really long time, you know? And it was just, you know, I didn't want to disappoint him or something, or it was just like, I had a weird thing about it. And really all of my most creative work, you know, most of the things that I actually recorded came after he passed away.
Right. Were you like a pretty interior kid? Like, did you have a lot of thoughts about these kinds of things and just kind of kept them because of the way that your dad had kind of like shown his feelings about like pursuing something like this? Or,
I mean, it wasn't like a thing like he ever said, oh, like, don't be a musician. Like, I'm sure he would have actually loved that. You know, like, you know, I think he always wanted to make his own music and he never really did. But it's just kind of the general attitude that, you know, he had towards us growing up. He was just very angry and upset all the time, you know, and he had like, you know, health problems. And I think that limited, you know, what he can do in his life, you know. So I think he was very frustrated about that.
Yeah.
But I don't know where to go from that.
Yeah, no. So writing about that, was that difficult to kind of like go into?
It was difficult. Yeah, I feel like it's something I never really talk about, or I never really told anybody about. And it's just, even like within my own family, I think it could be surprising for them to see me actually write about that. You know?
Is that, like, did you experience any sort of trepidation about even including in the book? Like, was there something where you're like, maybe I should hold back on certain things? Even though it's a memoir and you're supposed to be kind of telling your story, you know, everyone kind of self-edits.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely had moments like that, you know, where I wondered, you know, oh, you know, not so much is this something I want to hold back, but is this something that I want to go through the process of like remembering it and really and writing it and expressing it for everyone to see. But I felt like every time I had a feeling like that, where I was just like, oh, I don't want to talk about that, or like, oh, this is painful, I would lean into it. That was when I knew that I was going into something that was really meaningful, that was like had something true about it, something real about it, and I didn't want to run away from that feeling.
Right. Is that a conscious decision, or like a feeling in your heart that you have to kind of pursue that?
Well, it's just an impulse, you know. It's like, I feel like, you know, because I think, you know, the human mind, it does things where, you know, it tries to push you away from dealing with issues like that. Or, you know, it's like sometimes you can be your own worst enemy. And I feel like, you know, that feeling of like, oh, no, you shouldn't talk about that, is like something that obviously I should really, really talk about. Anytime I had that feeling, and it's like, it's the same thing creatively, like when I'm making music and stuff, like when, you know, it's like I'm making something and it's really out of my comfort zone, and maybe I'm like singing or like doing something that I don't normally do, and then I'm feeling like, oh, maybe I shouldn't do that, and it's like, I know that's a trigger in my mind to be like, I must do it now.
So this is the notion, like the well-worn easy path is maybe the path you should avoid, because it's, you've done it and it's not going to spark anything new. Whereas the difficult path is going to lead to something you haven't discovered before about yourself or about your music or your creativity.
Yeah, you know, I think it's also a thing where, you know, writing about a lot of this stuff was so cathartic for me. And I didn't know it was going to be, you know, but I just knew that I had to talk about it. And once I wrote it down, I felt it had less weight over me, you know, like a lot of these feelings that I've had. And yeah, it was a very freeing feeling.
Was the stuff with upper class cathartic?
Yeah. Then? Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Because the way the book is shaped, like, it feels like the shark in Jaws, where there's like glimpses of it and mentions of it and asides, and it's coming, and then you'd finally drop the chapter that like tells the whole story, and that's the shark mouth coming out of the water. Like, did you give some thought to like how you shape this story and how you integrate? I mean, because within each chapter there's some movement in terms of over time, and it's not necessarily like linear, like this year, chapter to chapter, right? Like you bounce back and forth depending on kind of the thematic structure of each chapter. But it seems like the upper class stuff is held in reserve until you're kind of finally ready to face it.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, that was obviously an intentional decision, you know, and for me, you know, I wanted to put in a little foreshadowing throughout. And I wanted to really express it that way because that's what it felt like for me when I was going through it. Like, it's just like, you know, there'd be a random day where, you know, something feels a little off, but no, I got to continue with my career. I got to keep doing what I'm doing. Got to stay focused on putting out this music. And then another weird thing would happen, and it would just be like, oh, you know, I need to deal with my finances, but, you know, I don't have time. I'm playing Glastonbury tomorrow, you know, like it's, and it keeps like pulling my focus away from what I'm doing until it gets to the point where I actually have to deal with it. And I think I tried to express that in the way that it's shown in the book.
Right. So the chapters then, like, were they written in sequence, or did you kind of like write sort of like different framings for each chapter, fill them out, and then like sort through as to kind of like which goes where? Like, what was kind of the structural sorting out?
Yeah, you know, it wasn't actually sequential. The way I wrote it was just based on my feeling at the time. You know, it was like what I felt like writing about at a given time. And I think the upper class chapter was probably one of the last things I wrote, because it was, you know, something I was putting off a lot, and really just emotionally, it took me a long time to get to the point where I could really unpack that stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, other stuff like, you know, the Poet Laureate chapter where I'm talking about lyricism, like I really enjoyed writing that and had a lot of fun writing it and was excited to write about my feelings about lyrics and stuff. And so that, you know, that came more quickly. And that was one of like the earlier ones I wrote. You know, the first two I wrote were the Bedroom Rapper chapter and the Universal Heartbeat.
Right. The DJ one that had been kind of reworked from the fictionalized.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the Bedroom Rapper used as kind of an epithet as far as a descriptor, more accurately, you're an attic rapper. It sounds like, because it was your mother's attic. But kind of taking a term that's used maybe to dismiss and, you know, making it the album title or making it the book title, making it like emblazoning it on your chest. I mean, that seems to be kind of an ethos of yours, right? Like, I mean, in the same way that like as a prairie rapper, you know, not getting recognition from Ontario and, you know, kind of being outside looking in is an experience you detail kind of over and over, whether it's in school, whether it's in the recording industry, whether it's in, you know, when you become poet laureate and you're an outsider as a poet laureate, that like all of these things kind of then you have to kind of put them on and then like wear them proudly in some sense. Is that just instilled from how you were raised? Is it like an internal process you've had to go through to kind of accomplish that as a person?
Well, you know, the thing is, I've always been an outsider in every aspect of my life, you know, and it's just what happens to me because of the way I think about the world and the way I perceive things, you know, so it's never that surprising. But yeah, the whole like Bedroom Rapper thing, you know, that's a classic hip hop kind of a maneuver. You know, it's like Eminem in 8 Mile, where, you know, you take the disc and you turn it around and, you know, it gives it makes it so there's nothing that somebody can diss you with, you know,
defanging.
So that
it
was like, yeah, exactly. You know, and it was like, you know, I, at the time I found it annoying because it's like, you know, like I'm making serious music. Like, I don't want it to be perceived as like, oh, I'm just making some demos in my attic or something. But now it's like become this rallying cry for me, you know. It's like, I, cause I was one of the first to really do it.
Yeah. You talk about, saying you became a rapper in a gradual, unplanned way. That's one of the lines that you write. Obviously you kind of get your start. You're interested in the rap music. You're on, you know, message boards in the like earliest days of the internet and Hipinion and things like that. Is it just cause it's like, I'm fascinated with these rappers, I'm fascinated with this music, that like it sparks something in terms of, I want to participate in this? And seeing someone like Nas like create Illmatic at the age of 20 suggests that it's possible as a young teenager that, you know, this is achievable, or at least, I mean, maybe I can't create the 5 mic rating record, but I can at least maybe shoot for a 3.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's like the you know, the fourth fathers who did things like that definitely inspired me. But, you know, for me, it's just, I was just so obsessed with rap, you know, as long as I can remember. It's like, I was listening to every record that came out. I listened to all the whole old canon of rap records. You know, I listened to everything, and I would just obsessively pore over the liner notes, and I wanted to know who recorded all the records, who engineered them. You know, I used to love looking at people's names of their publishing companies, you know, like Just Isn't Music, or like, you know, like I was just like, I'm gonna make one, you know, I can't wait until mine has this name or whatever, you know. And it's just that passion was always there for me, and I didn't see it really in anyone else I knew. You know, that was the other thing, is like, you know, there used to be kids who, you know, I'd write little raps with in school, or like, you know, people who would freestyle at like a house party or something. But I had this like single-minded determination to be like, I'm going to really make records. I'm going to really do this. I'm going to really sign a record deal. I'm going to, like, you know, my CD is going to be an HMV, you know? And it's like, I was the only person that I knew who felt like that.
Yeah. You pass a diss back and forth with a kid in your class. But that, I mean, I don't know that kid. I doubt he's recording, but,
yeah, he actually passed away.
Oh, that's so unfortunate.
Shout out to Devin, RIP.
But like, what was the impulse? Like, I'm going to do this, like, then, cause so many kids, yeah, like they were into rap, didn't become rappers. It just like clicked with you. Like this was like the way to express yourself, or.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it was like my, you know, catharsis, you know. It was something, especially cause I was such an interior person, and, you know, I have always been really emotional, and, you know, I've been considered myself like kind of a poetic person, you know, like I just always loved writing and music, and I always wanted to put them together in whatever way I could, you know. And it's just like this internal drive I've always had, you know. It's even when things were not going well in my career, you know, where it's like, okay, like I felt like I, you know, maybe it's over, you know, like, or I won't be able to come back, or, you know, when I had no record deal, I had no booking agent, I had no PR, I had nothing. I still really believed in myself, you know. I still thought, you know, I'll be able to make this work. I'm going to be able to do something, because I still felt like I had something to share with the world, you know. Like, I don't know, I just always had this feeling that I was born to like do this, you know.
Well, you end up at that period where you don't have the booking agent, you don't have the label. That, like, that's when you make the self-titled album.
Yeah.
That, like, that's the, like, youest you that there is, right? Like, and especially because you say, you know, as someone who grew up kind of tracking the careers and listening to the records of other artists, the late career self-titled record is, that's a significant thing to decide to call it that then.
Yeah, I think that's fire. Like, anytime I've seen it, it feels like a really definitive decision, you know. It's very meaningful. And yeah, for me, it was really like, yeah, this is a new beginning for me in every way I could imagine. You know, it was like, you know, I felt like I had artistically died, you know, before that record came out. You know, I hadn't put out an album for 6 years. You know, it's not a lot of people that have been able to come back after that long of a time, you know. And it wasn't like I was like this chart topping artist with like, you know, millions of fans or something where people were like, oh, wow, can't wait for you to come back. But it was, you know, I was surprised when I did finally, you know, I got a new record deal and I put out that record, that people did miss me, you know, and people were like, oh, yeah, I remember your records. And oh, yeah, I you know, like I feel like the Canadian music is a little more interesting when I'm around.
No doubt.
You know, if you know,
The thing I found interesting, I mean, I hadn't really like fully processed it when I got your that record when it first came out, but like that was kind of the first time a bunch of other producers were involved. Like you had other people's voices in terms of creating stuff for you. And then it was, and yet it was you as the center and the like person whose name was on the record. Like bringing in other people to then find yourself, like, was that part of that process?
Yeah, it was. It was kind of ironic, actually, you know, that a self-titled album that's like, oh, this is the real me. This is like, I'm coming back. And it involves, you know, more outside production, more collaborators than I've ever had before.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like that process of working with other people is part of what was able to get me back into the studio and get me back excited about music. You know, like I felt like I worked a lot with this guy, Gibbs. We made, you know, dozens of tracks together, you know, and it was like, not even thinking of like, oh, there's going to be an album, but it was just the idea of like, okay, I'm just getting my kind of my reps in, you know, and it's like, I'm exercising, you know, making music. And, you know, it really all springs from collaboration, you know, and it's like something that another thing I learned about that is that even though I'm not making the beats, I'm still executive producing these records. I'm still, you know, I'm curating it, you know, like I'm picking the beats, you know, I'm, you know, there's certain producers that I'm actively trying to work with, or, you know, like I kind of function as my own A&R a lot of the time.
Mm.
So, you know, even if I didn't make the beat, like, it's like, you know, a lot of those tracks, you know, I'd be like, oh, can you extend this section? Or like, can you take out this instrument? Or, you know, I'm still like involved in a lot of it. And, you know, in the case of the Parallel World, you know, I'm working with, you know, my mixing engineer and I'm like there with him. And, you know, I'm like, yo, can you extend this? Or can you make my vocal sound like this? Or like, you know, it always ends up coming out as like a Cadence Weapon record, you know?
Right. You have a vision for that record, regardless of whether you're getting someone else to help achieve that vision.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Are you someone who keeps a diary or like notes? Cause like you span a lot of years with a lot of detail.
Yeah.
Like how did you?
I don't.
No.
Actually, no. But what it was is I actually have all my old emails.
Oh.
So I have emails from like 2002, you know, and it's really painful to go through and look at emails you used to write. It's like really bad. I wouldn't recommend it. Like I used to write all lowercase, like, oh, it's just bad.
But like you were on an E.E. Cummings fix or?
Yes,
like...
exactly. I think I thought I was being artistic.
Was it partially like reading your voice in those emails too? Like does that?
Yeah. I mean, it was just, you know, very unprofessional emails all the time. You know, it was just weird. It's weird to look at the way you used to communicate with people, you know?
So when you would go to write a chapter, then you have kind of an overarching theme or message within each chapter. Then are you like typing like keywords into your Gmail to like find emails that pertain to that to then like try to flesh it out, or what's the process of that work?
Yeah, that was part of it. I would do that. But actually what I would do is if I'm looking at a particular year, I'd look at every email from that year.
Mm.
I would go through line by line and then I'd look and I'd be like, oh, I didn't remember doing that. Or it's like, oh yeah, that's when I did that. And so I would know exactly when certain things happened. Or, you know, I have like, I created, before I even wrote the book, really, I created a career outline based on, you know, just what I could remember. And then, you know, I even went through and I've, you know, collected every show I've ever played, you know, and, you know, when they happened and like, what are the circumstances around them? So those things would be good markers for me to remember other stuff.
So then that's like, you know, oh, I was here. Oh, now I remember that meal that I had after that set or something like that, that it's like sparking memories.
But it's the thing is, I actually have an insane memory.
Okay.
Anyway, like I have really good recall for, you know, specific dates and things that happened, and I remember all this stuff. Like all my other artist friends like don't remember. And I'm also like a big archivist. Like I collect everything from like posters and flyers and old albums by people. Like I have records that, you know, my friends made in Montreal that nobody has copies of, and I've looked on Discogs and they're worth like hundreds of dollars and stuff. And it's just kind of funny. Like it's like I always make sure that I get it, you know, because like you never know. Like I'm just like a very sentimental person.
Is that, I mean, you know, your dad was a record collector and a DJ. Is that partially like the impulse is like handed down, like, oh, you know, this ephemera, these like 12 inches, these like white labels
could be
part of my set eventually.
You know, it might be hereditary for sure. I mean, my mom's the same way. Like my mom still has the record collection. She has like, you know, she's she has like a sign that says music on the wall and like her record player and her speakers and stuff. So it's like, you know, it definitely runs in the family.
For sure. I mean, there's definitely a family story that runs through this book. Now that this memoir is out, are you going to write another, like, do you have like the obviously you reworked that fictional DJ thing, but like, do you have like a fiction story in you that you want to write or something else that's kind of like germinating?
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm going to be writing more and more. Like this is not going to be the only book. Like I'm already talking about the next book.
Right on. Well, the book,
you know, it might be, then it'll probably be another nonfiction book. But, you know, I think somewhere down the line, I want to do fiction. Like, I love writing. You know, I think, you know, there's going to be a time in my life where maybe I'm writing more than I make music.
Well, the book is called Bedroom Rapper, Cadence Weapon on Hip Hop, Resistance, and Surviving the Music Industry. Raleigh Pemberton, thanks for taking some time to talk about it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.